for those not actually present in the room who wanted to know why there's no Zoom link, well, that wouldn't be like me, but there will be audio available on the website tomorrow for those who didn't want to come today, and that should suffice to meet the needs of the moment. I suppose now going to try to conclude the course I should have taught instead of the one I actually taught, which is it's a strange place to be. In you know, I like to think that this is the end of my 37th year of teaching. I will begin my 38th year, if above ground, in September. You would think that by now I would have figured out how to know which course I was supposed to teach at any given slot in the schedule, and it's weird to have mistaken what needed to be done quite so deeply as to find myself now at the last minute actually trying to conclude the thing I didn't do instead of the thing I did. But here I am, and so I must. So let's reach all the way back for those few people in the room who actually started all this in September with me. Let's reach all the way back to the very beginning of the thing and check where we really are. We, as the human race, have been building for almost all my lifetime and are now completing at a rapid cadence the task of assembling a neurological system, a new nervous system, external to human bodies, but embracing every human being, pretty much now almost all the human beings on the planet, soon every single human being, and in the course of the lifetime of the generation following yours, that neural system, that nervous system embracing all of humanity, will be in touch with every human brain from birth until death. At that point, the human species is essentially a superorganism, held together by a system of communications external to each individual entity, the thing we call a person. This development, this enwrapping of the human species in a network of our own making, this creation of a nervous system for the species rather than for individual organisms, was entirely foreseeable. We knew that that would happen more than half a century ago when I was a tween. I mean the young people whose immediate lives began to be changed by that technology at the first moment in human history when that was possible, an event I simply happened randomly to be born to. But therefore, there was fear about what that nervous system would contain from the beginning of its existence, when it was still barely hooking up. In order for the nervous system embracing humanity to exist, it had to be possible to take all the different flavors of computers that existed, all their various different ways of representing characters and communicating data, all the various quillets and strangenesses of the particular engineers who built particular computers, it had to be possible to take all those things and make them talk to one another with complete agnosticism about how each individual computer worked. We needed to take a nervous system, a bunch of nervous cells, little computers, things that aren't so little now to us, you know, stuff the size of multiple refrigerator freezers and so on, but we had to take those things and figure out a way that they could be made to talk to one another in which nobody had to understand how each individual one represented data, because they could all communicate without regard to their internal activity. The people who needed that most were the militaries of the United States and their research arms, which is why beginning in the 1970s, they and AT&T, the dominant computer company, began trying to figure out how networks of networks could occur, how heterogeneity could nonetheless lead to sufficient similarity that everybody could communicate with everybody. That task essentially came to first fruition in 1975 and 1976, when a thing called the ARPANET, named after the Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Defense Department, came into existence and began linking up the military and research arms of the United States military-industrial complex. That summer in 75, as a 16-year-old, I was writing my piece of the first networked email distribution system in the world, and one of my high school pals, Lee Parks, was sitting at the Center for Supercomputing Research in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, where the ARPANET was being put together. We were the kids who were there inside those moments when those first things began to happen. Therefore, because we were readers of the science fiction of our time, which was almost altogether, whether it was written in English or in Russian or in any European language, the science fiction of our time was mostly about nuclear weapons and the unintended consequences of technology that could destroy worlds, which was what we read about and what we thought about, and therefore what we thought about the human nervous system that we knew was being constructed. We understood that one day it would be everywhere and that everything would communicate through it, and therefore that it could be, as Orwell had thought about things in 1984, it could be a machine for the extirpation of human freedom. So we started to try to figure out what to do about that. As a consequence of which I am standing here a half a century later, not knowing which course I have been teaching, because we thought in technical terms about this. I was a technical kid, but I was also a historian kid and a humanities kid. And so my particular part of that evolving system, which technically was about how computer languages should work, how we should communicate between the human and non-human parts of the nervous system we were building, my technical work seemed to me also to involve the question, what does human history have to teach us about what is going to happen at the moment when all of this gels and freedom depends upon the way that software lives in networks? And so over the course of that half century between then and now, that was pretty much the stuff I specialized in. And the course I taught, the one that you were so kind as to listen to, but maybe wasn't the one you most needed, is in some sense a course about that, right? It's a course about how, if you understand the history of our law and the history of the societies that made that law, you can begin to understand what will happen when the technologies of network communication become complete. And what people called freedom depends upon the behavior of computer networks. This, in whatever form it was that after various adventures in dissertation writing and PhD getting in history and life spent teaching legal history in a supposedly great law school and all of that, what that comes to when we actually begin to try and assess where we live now, what the law says now, what it means now, and how it works now. A course which I have taught in this place since 1999, but which in some sense I now begin to realize has changed meaning almost altogether. The biggest problem in the work that I thought I was doing between 1988 and the day before yesterday, that is when as a young law teacher I first figured out that I would have the time and leisure actually to affect what was going on in the world if only I could figure out how, The time spent was largely spent doing things that seemed to me to relate to the technical issues still at hand. Could we pump enough software for freedom into that network? Could we make rules which would sustain that freedom-loving software for as long as possible? Could we actually make capitalism regard that kind of freedom-supporting software as so valuable that it would take it up and use it and put it everywhere and allow us, therefore, the technical possibility that in the long run we could turn freedom back on? That work was, from my point of view, practical work. It required changing the nature of the software industry in the world, changing how software was made, changing how that network was populated, in the hope that people would ultimately discover that they needed, politically, socially, that they needed the political forms of liberty, which only the forms of technology we were trying to make would keep safe for them. The great enemy in the problem was that people didn't know that the problem existed at all. Some geeks knew, some programmers knew. It became possible for us to generate legal rules about sharing software that young computer programmers, people who came to call themselves hackers, would find valuable because they would care about the social meaning of what the technology would do, but largely in a world in which almost everybody else had no idea that there was a relationship between software and freedom, or how to characterize that relationship, or how to worry about the practical consequences of what would happen if software came to control human behavior in this great big species-wide network and it didn't have human values at its root and it didn't have concern for human freedom at its core. And for most of the first 20 years that I taught this course, it was probably right to think in those terms. I was communicating esoteric material, partly constitutional history, but partly technological possibility, to people for whom the real difficulty was that the big issue was still obscure. It isn't anymore. One of the reasons that there are so many smart and capable and highly energetic people who are going to live important lives in the next generation in this room is that the problem is no longer obscure. The thing that worried us from childhood, that computer networks would come into existence, that they would wrap themselves around everything, that human beings would then be dependent upon the way that the software that generated the physiology of that anatomy, that made it work, that human beings would come to depend in their daily lives, in life or death circumstances, upon how that software functioned, that was impossible to teach, even to the brightest people in the world in this law school, which is, of course, the brightest law school in the world, a generation ago. Now it's trivial. I don't have to do it. You knew that before you signed up. And so part of what is going wrong is that I'm still teaching as though the hardest thing I had to communicate is now, in fact, a ground rule, a ground-based belief that everybody brings with them. The problem is that people now understand that their freedom is threatened, but they have no idea what to do about it. The primary difficulty that we are now confronting is a kind of difficulty that lawyers are aware of all the time. Namely, there is something deeply wrong with the world, and if we could only get people to pay attention to it and hire us to go and fix it, maybe we could go and fix it. Which is the right thing for lawyers to think, but people don't know how to fix it. And I'm still teaching a course about 18th century search and seizure and trying to communicate the ways in which the values of constitutional liberty are either at odds with or consistent with 21st century. Why am I doing that? And this is why, over the course of this course, I learned that I was teaching the wrong course, because I realize, as I read your writing, that everybody is in the position of having one or another formulation which amounts to an understanding that this is what could go wrong and is going wrong. But people keep throwing up their hands, clever and dedicated as you are. I tend to think of that as, well, you are smart-ass phone owners and users, and therefore, of course, you're screwed. But it isn't really the point. That, too, I'm overconscious of. I know how badly you got ripped by the building of that nervous system. Because having been inside it from the beginning, I knew perfectly well how to avoid falling into all the holes you have fallen into. I never needed to have a smart-ass phone, and I never had one. I never wanted to use services that were given to me on the basis of you can have this if you allow us to surveil you. That was the deal I was always against. So I never came to it. And the technology that I used was always the technology we made to support human freedom. So for me, it was always easy to say you don't have to fall in. And I have also fundamentally, therefore, been teaching incorrectly for at least the last decade. Because although I was in touch with people's helplessness, I actually, in some condescending asshole law professor kind of way, considered that to be your fault. And that's, of course, the basic mistake of every teacher, and the worst one you can make, right? to blame the fact that students don't know something on students. And that, too, therefore, has kicked back hard against me as I've watched you come up against the kinds of social problems that were characteristic of the 1960s in the 2020s when you are already holding the technology that hurts you. So that, too, becomes a real mistake. The kind of mistake which happens to teachers in times of high social conflict when they realize that they're just not preparing people very well for the world in which they're actually supposed to live, or forced to live, or having to live. And so I see the way in which, although it would be nice to continue in my declining years, comma, if any, comma, to continue to teach the way I did before, I can't do it. And this has to be the last time I do this course this way. Because we're already inside the network that we have worried about, and it has already been infected by a disease of unfreedom which is capable of overthrowing the very idea of human liberty as I understood it at the beginning, when as a child I began to foresee a technological conflict and wish to head it off. That nervous system that we built that embraces humanity, like the nervous system inside your own body, fundamentally operates in terms of services. Your nervous system performs services for you. One of the most important ones, of course, is that it enables motion. It carries the impulses which cause your muscles to contract and relax, and which makes physical motion in the world possible, and therefore, of course, the opposable thumb that you don't use anymore because you spend all your time typing like this, and the ability to coordinate across all those 10 fingers with absolute control that makes it possible not just to run a keyboard like the ones the King of the Undead Now Dead makes, the bad ones, but the good ones on the Steinways, and the glory of human beings, that our nervous system provides us with that kind of fine motor control. It also provides us with extraordinary sensory sophistication, eyes and ears and smells and tastes and touches, and does so in highly complicated ways that software only begins to be capable of reaching towards at its very best. Your brain, for example, has to synthesize a synchronization between what you see and what you hear. You take for granted that when you look at the world, when you listen to the world, when you are in the world, that you are present at an experience in which my lips move and the sound comes out and it's all happening synchronously. But that's not actually the way that your nervous system is dealing with it. Your brain has to work much harder to interpret. I'm sorry, I should never have allowed food garbage to be anywhere close to anybody. And just leave it, Jane. What can we do with it? The nervous system in your brain at its best requires approximately 11 milliseconds more time to understand what you are looking at than the time it needs to understand what you are hearing. And so it actually has to delay what you are hearing by 11 milliseconds and then resynchronize it at the other end. When it's finished, when your brain is finished processing the video, then it has to go and get the audio, which it has already finished and has been holding in short-term storage, and sync it up. There's an awful lot of complicated processing that goes on in you in order to synthesize a world which you then take as natural. You, but primates, see what they believe, what they see, and imagine what they hear. You see things, you think that you're hearing the same things at the same moment, you are coordinating, imagining, all sorts of complicated function is going on. And in that process, of course, a world is coming into existence for you and only you, to which only you have access, which you control. About 11 or 12 milliseconds after that, in the world in which you now live, the network external to you has become aware of what you are seeing, hearing, thinking, feeling. Already that neuron that you carry around with you, that you expensively maintain, that you take care of, that you charge up every night, all that stuff is busy trying to work its way inside that experience of being in your world. The brain performs, the nervous system inside your body performs other services beyond fine motor coordination and the synthesis of your very complicatedly sensed environment. It produces emotions which keep you alive or interfere with your continuing to live. It correlates those emotions with a very complicated set of understandings of the human beings around you, which you have for some millions of years now been evolving. And all of those services are rendered within a political economy internal to the human being, which we know requires complex nurturance. It needs good care in infancy and childhood. It needs adequate food and security physically. It needs enough sleep. But the services are rendered in an economy which doesn't subject you to control if you have a certain basic sufficiency. Of course, we deny that basic sufficiency to a large portion of the human race. We always have. The way to think about that is that we starve to death almost every brain in the human race, almost all the time. Hence, the reason that a young person thinking about these things half a century ago might have come to the conclusion, as I did come to the conclusion, that the most important ultimate social outcome of a well-functioning human species-wide network would be that it would reverse that starvation and allow every brain on Earth to learn whatever it wanted, wherever it was, at any time, without regard to the ability to pay or the whims of government. In other words, to replace the arbitrary controls which cause the starvation of most human brains ever, always, all the time, and to reverse that process by using the new network, the new nervous system of the human race, to redress that fundamental imbalance, the one we call ignorance, the one that also benefits power so asymmetrically. But you think in terms of services in that larger nervous system, the one that now embraces us, and the understanding of services is a little bit more straightforward, right? We break the services up into things like email, video conferencing, file sharing, synchronization. Though, as you are aware, it gets more complicated. The nature of the relationship between human beings and text, that is, the literacy that has over the past 700 years, particularly the last 500, altered human life beyond anybody's expectations, that system of literacy is altered by this network. How you read has changed, therefore it is possible to destroy your library and you won't care. I am constantly reminded as I visit the ghost of our library, as I walk those empty spaces, the bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang, I'm constantly aware of the fact that if you felt as outraged by what has happened as I do, then it wouldn't be happening. But you don't, because already your relationship to memory and text has been altered by the nervous system that embraces humanity, and the service of opening to you the text, the service which used to be performed by the form of memory we call library, is now performed instead by a network to which you make queries and receive text in service return on the deal that you allow the machine to know what you are reading at all times and to watch you reading it. A deal of which at age 14 I was so afraid that I cannot conceive of how I would have succeeded in educating myself if I had grown up in your world instead of mine, the one in which the books reported readers at headquarters, a thing that literally would have nauseated me. So the services that we think of in that network, the ones that we take in relatively small technical terms, video conferencing, email, the sharing of files, the reading of text, the use of the web, the hypertext structure invented by Ted Nelson more than 70 years ago, that shape inside the nervous system that we are part of now determines what human life is like. And the thing about the services as they are presently architected, as you understand, is that they are broken up into organs. Things we call, for example, Gmail, Facebook, Zoom, etc. And those organs are part of a larger structure, how software operates the network that holds human beings together. The form in which that organ operates, each one of them, is that services are provided in the network in return for an equal and opposite service on the other side, in a kind of Newtonian pairing. Everything you get, something is extracted for. The political economy of that network, then, is unlike the political economy of your own nervous system. It operates by taking something from you which is more than what it gives back. What is collected in return for the services you use, all of them, the communications, the empowerments, don't forget, of course, the, what shall we call them, the species reproduction applications, right? I mean, remember that from a Darwinian point of view, structures of biological relevance that have tight relationship to reproduction are extensively naturally selected, right? Everything that has to do with the reproduction of individual organisms is the place where evolution concentrates its attention. That's Darwin's fundamental point. The reason that Hinge and Tinder and those things are so important, well, because that is actually where the evolution of the human species is selected for, in this nervous system that we now have, because it is tightly coupled to reproduction. Anyway, never mind. The services, whichever ones they are, including enabling you to reproduce the species by having sexual contact with other human beings, about which you ought to be highly conscious, the services in the network are offered to you on the basis of a price. The price is allowing your behavior to be collected and understood in a form previously unavailable. This new nervous system can do the job of acquiring, organizing, and expressing conclusions about human behavior in a way that never existed before. That's the new thing in this network. And what happens is that you are given services, various kinds, all of which you come to feel are integral to the life of the human being, in the same way that you feel that fine motor control or careful listening and thoughtful looking are integral to the being of the human. On the basis that what happens is that in return for your being allowed to behave, enabled to behave, in return for the humanness of your behavior, you surrender that behavior to an entity which metabolizes it, turns it into energy. The metabolizing of that behavior results in the injection into the environment. We could call it the secretion of hormones that increase your tendency to behave, right? A whole series of new emotions and response patterns develops in human beings that result from the acquisition of behavior by these centralized software entities and their emission of new stimuli that cause more behavior to occur. That's a biological-like process, right? I mean, we understand how that happens in all sorts of ways. An organism, biologically active, interacts with another organism we could call the host, modifies its behavior or biological processes in order to produce benefit to the thing that is living off the host, the thing we call the parasite. Parasitism is a fundamental and well understood biological structure, making a living off another living thing. The software organisms that populate those structures we call Facebook and Gmail, and those software structures therefore play a specific biologically describable role. They metabolize human behavior and they emit stimuli that cause more human behavior, thus orienting the human activity inside the species towards its own needs and its own benefit. Because these software organisms exist within a system we call capitalism, they function for the benefit of capital. That is, they make money. And because they exist in relation to things that aspire to monopolies of violence and coercive force within particular territories, the things we call states, they function on behalf of the states as well. They're profit sharers in that sense. But their underlying behavior is the collection of behavior and the stimulating of more behavior. And you're aware of that now. It was hard for us to talk about that in the future tense 25 or 30 years ago. Before 2010, before the beginning of what we call Web 2.0 or social media or whatever you want to call the development of the parasite's biological capacity, human beings were entirely unconscious of its presence or of its potential. Not so now. People like you, literate, intelligent, well wired up, with access to the technology and increasingly absolutely dependent upon it, in order to live what you think of as human life, are also aware of what is being scraped out of you. And you're aware of the immense profit or state power at the other end. It's still necessary to spend a moment thinking about the comprehensiveness of what this parasitical structure acquires. The problem of academic psychology in the 20th century was solved in one of those usual American ways, very very vigorous, very ingenious, very different, and in some fundamental sense, very capitalist. The problem of academic psychology in the 20th century was like the problem of academic psychology in the 19th or in the 18th, as the very idea of studying the human mind in a systematic way came into being. The problem was that psychology is hobbled by its subject. It tries to study the human mind, and that gets in the way. It's burdensome. It's a poorly understood concept that whose difficulties in specification bother everybody. And so the Americans, and in particular Americans, developed in the 20th century a solution to the fundamental underlying problem of how to do psychology. The recognition was, if we just got rid of the idea of mind, it would be so much simpler. And so behaviorism came into existence as a distinctively American way of solving the problem of psychology by eliminating the idea of mind. What Skinner and the other pioneers of behaviorism did was to evolve a way in which you could think about the science of mind without mind. If you did that simply on the basis that there are stimuli in the world and responses in the thing with a mind, and that if you understood all the stimuli and all the responses, then you wouldn't need to have a concept of mind. You would be sufficiently aware of what was going on, and even the ability to change what was going on simply by modifying the balance of stimulus and response in the human environment. The important thing to understand then is that there is an intersection between that idea of what human psychology is and what we made of human psychology by building the network around it. The software that we call the parasite is a behaviorist. What it has is access to an unbelievably rich environment of correlations of stimulus and response. Billions of people, thousands of times a day, interacting with stimuli emitted by that software into the network and responding. Trillions of daily interactions amounting to a correlation between stimulus and response. Machine said X, you swiped, clicked, failed to swipe or click, did this, thought this, your pulse rate went up, your pulse rate went down, all those questions, all of that producing what we call big data and all of it being subject to what we call artificial intelligence, which really means hypotheses generated by software on the basis of correlations between measured stimulus and measured response. If you do this for long enough, say 6 or 7 generations, you will eliminate the human mind because the human mind will no longer have any purpose in that sense. Behaviorism will have become prediction. But we don't have to worry about that right now. We're still at the beginning of it. All we have to observe is that what is occurring to the human being is what might have been said to be occurring in the Skinner box. You have a bunch of buttons. There are a bunch of banana pellets. You press the button, you get the reward, the experimenter remembers. The breadth of that, trillions of points a day, across billions of human beings, produces at the other end, where all of that information is collected, a view of human beings, which is very special. On the one hand, every single human individual is really known to the extent that behaviorism can ever know a human mind. In addition to your smart-ass phone, you have a Nest thermostat, and you have some other gear around you, and it knows how often you flush the toilet, and how long after you open the refrigerator you go to the bathroom, and what is on your television or your YouTube or whatever it is that is the endpoint close to your eyeball and your eardrum at the moment that you either decide to open the refrigerator or flush the toilet. You know a good deal about human mating behavior. You know about how it is created. You know about how it goes on. The human being is known in a detailed kind of way. Not a sparrow falls, but it is measured. And yet, on the other hand, the largest inferences possible, the emergent properties of being human, the things you could only know about human beings if you knew 1 billion or 2 billion of them all the time, if you could hold all of that in one place, so that you could see both every sparrow fall and every toilet being flushed, and also all the largest emergent properties of what it means to be the human race at any given moment, snapshots across the whole of the species all the time. Those two forms of understanding overlapping one another. The largest inferences and the smallest details coexisting inside a memory that never quits and never dies. Human beings never really thought about the condition of living inside that before. It was never possible. Occasionally we hypothesized it. We dreamed it up. We imagined something like that. A knowledge so comprehensive that it both knew every sparrow's fall and the largest destinies of the whole of the race. When we imagined that at all in the human past, we called it the mind of God. And so now we live inside a nervous system we have built across the species, soon embracing every human brain from birth to death, aware of and collecting all human behavior, stimulating the result of more human behavior for the purpose of powering the parasite, and that parasite possesses what we call the mind of God. Teaching about that at the end of the 20th century or the beginning of the 21st was a job I enjoyed doing, but I wasn't very good at it because nobody understood what the fuck I was talking about. Now you do. You just don't actually know what it is or what to do about it, but you can feel it's there. You can feel the manipulations of human emotion now occurring, the ways in which the parasite is causing over-behavior to occur. You can feel the ways in which forms of human rationality that depended upon human time, upon people existing in sequence, learning from one another, have given way to things of immediacy, in which a bunch of stuff seems to be happening to human beings in parallel, and it's very difficult for them to slow things down enough to restore a sense of sequence. Because, of course, the parasite doesn't need mind and doesn't use time. It correlates. So you begin to have the emotion that in my writing at the end of the last decade I called the nausea accompanying metamorphosis. You know the species is changing. You know that you are changing. You know that the way in which you are changing is that the idea of the mind is somehow varied now and isn't your own. We're big on body horror now, as we should be. We're full of literary and cinematic explorations of what it means to be going through metamorphosis. And we fool as we fool with fright and flight and the adrenaline system of the human being. We fool using our culture with the image of what it means to be irrevocably changing in potentially nauseating ways that we don't fully understand and can't fully control under the impulse of biologies that are not our own. It's a three-body problem now. So, in a way, the thing to do is to start in medias res. You already know all this. All the effort that I've spent all these years in all these classrooms trying to bring that idea into existence, I should stop doing that now. You have that idea. The problem is that you don't know what comes next. And the weird part, of course, is that what comes next is going to be some kind of technical, factual, biochemical kind of stuff. Because if we ever actually really wanted to come to grips with this, we could no longer do it by ripping the network out. You understand that. Right? We are at that stage in metamorphosis where if we actually tried to reverse the process, we would kill ourselves. So everybody feels that therefore they have no choice, because how could I live without Google? And that's part of how we find ourselves politically disempowered by the biological reality within which we now live. It's part of why we want data protection law or a better Fourth Amendment or something to come along and somehow provide us with an immunity against the form of metamorphosis through which we are going, of which we now know enough to be afraid, of which we know in some obscure sense that we cannot go back, and in which we are inadequately informed to go forward safely. So we hurtle along. And not only do we hurtle along, but we reproduce the species on the usual time scale. And therefore, when we are young, we have children, and we subject children to the reach of the parasite. And we begin to notice that we are accelerating the process through the natural reproduction of ourselves, except that we are not quite any longer ourselves. To treat this as a matter of constitutional law seems in a way just ridiculously complacent. But when I ask you to write, you write about the companies, the platforms, the things. It's not that you don't see those connections already fully. You have grown to that. You see, we've all fallen off a cliff together. And my mistake, among other mistakes, is to think that I can somehow make you understand that you just shouldn't do it anymore. But that won't work. So here we are at the end of this misaligned effort. And now, at the end, I'm trying to catch up. Questions so far? The publishers, even more than the technology.
Right.
You were taught how to interact with the oligopolists of knowledge.
Yeah, so with that...
Users, you were. Yes, go ahead, Sergeant.
Yeah, with that being said, and not overlaid in so many other areas of our lives, how are we to defend the privacy rights that we...
Right. So now, instead of teaching that for 14 weeks, I can teach it for 1 hour and 59 minutes. But you're right. That's what I ought to do. And so that's what I'm going to try and do today, right? Because that, without that, you're right. The whole thing is obviously a blunder. That's what I feel. That's how taking this course by standing here has made me feel over these weeks. We think it's about this, the sense of the maintenance of some sphere of human integrity in ourselves, and we use that word for it, it's privacy, whatever that means. And it turns out, as I said before, tediously, but not incorrectly, that we can break that into three pieces. That's our ability to keep secrets. Without secrecy, we will not have the integrity of personality. It will blend into that network. The parasite will ultimately become the arbiter of what we are because it will know all our secrets. We have to have a way of differentiating how we are known, identity, from who we are, what we think. If we can't dissociate identity as understood it from some third-party location and ourselves, then we will lose our integrity because everything will be tracked and attributed and we will never experience again the feeling of just being ourselves, walking, loafing, and strolling. Justice Douglas says in Doe against Bolton, the case which, after all, is about abortion. Our ability to manage our bodily integrity depends on this. The New York Times was writing only yesterday, I'm sure you saw, about all of the effort now to figure out what to do with the information about women actually having abortions, legally, under circumstances in which their danger is enormously increased by the parasite's awareness of what has happened. It used to be 10 years ago or 15 that I could stand in a classroom and say, you know, Amazon and Google know when you're pregnant before you do. And Facebook knows when you've fallen in love before you know. But that was all old-time stuff for me to say. Now I need to point out that the parasite knows you were pregnant and terminated in a society in which that is becoming criminal activity instead of a woman's right. An example of the way in which the parasite's relationship to us is ultimately very scary indeed. Because anything which happens in the world which limits our freedom to act and think and be ourselves on the basis of invasion of our secrecy or denial of our anonymity is a threat to our autonomy, which is in the end what our privacy is about. So now, if we are actually to confront what is happening to us, if we are aware of the nausea of metamorphosis, if we are aware that something is changing, and if we know that the nervous system, which ties us all together, can no longer be ripped out in the same way that our own nervous system intrapersonally cannot be ripped out without killing us, then we need to understand how at some sufficiently biological level, we can restore secrecy and anonymity and autonomy despite the presence of the parasite. Which means that we're going to have to understand both how to attain directly the objectives of secrecy and anonymity, and also how we are to interfere with the forms of service provision which currently tie us to the parasite by requiring us to use the nervous system in a fashion which complies with the nature of the infection. Questions? Okay, then. So here are some exercises which I have suggested, perhaps more than writing another paper about the no-law zone that is data protection or the platforms or search and seizure in the 21st century, might be the better way to help you learn. Might actually be responsive to what the course ought to be instead of what I have been allowing it to be all this time in a fruitless way. Restoring secrecy actually means learning how to communicate with other people in a fashion which preserves your right to exist undisturbed by third parties. For reasons that are partly historical and partly functional, what that means, among other things, is that you need to know how to keep your email to yourself, how to keep your files private, how to send things between you that aren't simply parasite food waiting to become parasite shit. Hence technical project number one, the use of GPG, or the pretty good privacy from which it springs, to create secrecy that you can actually use. One of the problems of secrecy you can actually use is that most forms of secret communication in human history have depended upon the pre-existence of a shared secret. If Bob and Carol wish to talk secretly, the first thing they have to do is agree on a code book, a cipher, some form or mechanism which will allow them to communicate secretly with one another. If they have a good shared secret, their secrecy can be perfect. That's the meaning of the so-called one-time pad, a form of communication that developed out of nuclear confrontation in the 20th century. If you and I have between us a pad of encryption key, mathematical material which we can use to obscure our communication, and we use every number on that pad one time only, we never repeat a key, the only thing that joins us is our shared copies of the one-time pad, then we do in fact have perfect secrecy. The communications that result, encrypted by keys that are only used once and then thrown away, is in theory perfect encryption. The only problem is there's a vulnerability. Those pads exist, and if their secrecy is compromised, everything is lost. What we would really like to have is something almost as good as a one-time pad that doesn't require sharing the pad. We would like to be able to make strong secrecy without having to pre-exchange a secret. That's what so-called public key cryptography, the mathematics of which began to be worked out in the mid-1970s, allows us to do. You can sort of understand the way public key cryptography works if you think about the bank night deposit box in the wall of the bank near you. If you're a small business person who works in a cash business, you're well acquainted with it. On the outside of the bank wall, there is a door which has a lock on it. Though that lock has an essentially public key. Every depositor of the bank has a key to open that door. And therefore, they can open the door and throw in a bag full of money and a deposit slip at the end of the night after closing, and that thing will fall into the inside of the bank, where it can only be opened on the other side by a much more secret key that belongs to some trusted bank employee who comes in and opens up that door in the morning. If you think about it, the night deposit box at the bank works the way we want our system of secrecy to work. The keys to the outside door are not very worrying. You can lose one, you can throw one in the river, you can have it stolen while you're drunk by somebody who doesn't like you. It's okay. It's the secret key to the door inside the bank that is the one that has to be carefully guarded. The bank night deposit box, then, is a system of secrecy without a shared secret. We should say a system of security. But those deposit slips are secrets. So public key encryption functions that way. You have two keys, a public key and a private key. The public key can belong to anybody. Anybody can use it. You can publish it in a directory. We do. Anybody who wants to send you something secret can encrypt it using your public key. The only person who can get that thing back out is you, because you have the secret key. And only you have the secret key. That's the one you keep carefully in being. If we want you to have good secrecy, then, in the 21st century, we need to offer you something like that. You already use a lot of software which is like that. Your browser's way of browsing securely, when you touch a URL that has HTTPS at the front of it, that S, the Hypertext Protocol Secure variant, uses public keys. You're not aware of them. You have some, the web servers have some, you all challenge one another, somebody emits a challenge and you prove that you have a browser key, and Citibank proves that it has a Citibank key, and therefore your browser and the bank think they can talk. But you don't have any control over all that, and you barely know that it is there. And the software does way too much for you. It doesn't really show you where the bones are. Exercise number one about the use of GNU Privacy Guard, or Pretty Good Privacy, is about teaching you how to use these things at a sufficiently biological level that you can really understand how they work. In the course of exercise number one, you make two keys, a public key and a private key. You distribute the public key to everybody by putting it on a server. You keep the private key. Now you have acquired a way that other people can communicate with you secretly and securely without ever having to have a shared secret. They have only a public fact, your public key. Anybody could have it. But that allows them to communicate securely with you. Now that you know how to do that, you can also help them to do that. That means they can have a public key and a private key, and the two of you can now communicate back and forth securely without having actually ever exchanged a state secret, a shared secret. So if one of you was living in an even more dangerous place than the other was, if Bob is in the People's Republic of China and Alice is in Greenland, they can still conduct completely secret communication, even though bad people have been listening to them all the while. They had no shared secret, no secret was ever compromised, and yet by their bootstraps they were able to pull up a line of communication which the intervening listeners cannot compromise. Yes, Jermel? No, my wiki doesn't need it. It operates HTTPS-wise through all similar kinds of machinery. But everybody who finishes exercise number one now has a secret channel of communication with me, because my public key is available to one and all. And they have used it to send me an encrypted message. That was how they proved that they completed exercise number one. And they have either put a key on the key servers or they have mailed me a key. And therefore, we can now communicate securely, and you have learned how to do that with any other person on Earth you might want to have do it, because all of that software is freely available to everybody. Once upon a time, that software was controlled by the United States government as munitions, and sending it around the world was therefore exporting munitions, and therefore Philip R. Zimmerman, who created Pretty Good Privacy, was destined for jail, but we prevented that from happening. The process of doing that made some law that protected secrecy in the world, which was my objective in deciding in 1988 that there would have to be a Zimmerman, and I would have to defend him, and we would have to break those rules about controlling secret keeping, or there would never be secrets anymore. All of that public key encryption material, all of the ways of doing that, all the math underneath it, are now embedded in lots of other tools that people need and use. But by learning how to operate it at the atomic level, you become empowered to do all the things you want to do in a way that is possible to teach other people so they can do it too. That's the purpose of exercise number one, working secrecy for real people, strong enough to resist real national means of intelligence and really available to you. We know enough about the way the listeners of the world work to know that unless they have got a secret underground quantum computer that nobody on Earth knows they have, They don't bother trying to break that encryption. They just steal the keys. The security of your own systems and of your own secret key ring is the most important thing to prevent compromise. Technical failure in the encryption system, though it is inevitable sooner or later because all software has bugs, technical failure is no longer the primary danger. If you learn how to take key, if you learn how to make keys, publish keys to one another, and keep your secret keys private, you have strong enough secrecy to resist even the best listeners in the world. But this is not. But this encryption is not secret that it's secret. You can be seen to be using PGP. If you are corresponding with somebody in the People's Republic of China, the system is aware that you are engaged in secret correspondence. Under certain circumstances, that might be enough of a reason to interfere with a human being. That is to say, to use violence and force. Nothing prevents that from happening here. We aren't there yet. Because we are engaged in supporting secrecy, we are not yet engaged in supporting anonymity. As I have explained before, anonymity is much harder to achieve in a technical sense. We can have good secrecy because the mathematics of encryption are, at least until quantum computing becomes fundamentally available to all states and capital entities in an easygoing way, we have math sufficient to create secrecy. But the very nature of the way our nervous system works, the very nature of the way we built the net, in which packets contain both source and destination addresses within them necessarily. Every piece of information moving in the net says where it came from and says where it is going to, intrinsically means that the separation of identity from communication is difficult. It can't be perfectly achieved. Every packet still has to say where it came from and where it goes to. And so, as we were discussing last time, we wind up using structures that maneuver packets around, fly them from place to place unnecessarily, cross them through borders, move them through machines that don't have, and we use enough secrecy in that process that it becomes difficult for an onlooker to observe how every packet moved. That process of toroidal routing, sending things on circular journeys, which creates the thing called Tor, then gives us something like a kind of possible, but functionally almost good enough anonymity. We are still laying that on top of a nervous system which isn't built for it. We are still confronting basic architectural rules disadvantageous to the idea of separating identity from substance of communication, attaining anonymity, but we're getting close. Precisely because so much of the fundamental software that operates the network is passively hostile to anonymity, if we really want to give you something close to workable anonymity, we really need to change the way your computers function. We actually want to operate your computer differently. Hence the value of Tails. Hence the nature of exercise number two. It will work with any email. It will even work with Gmail, which is your school email, although LionMail pretends not to be. But it's Gmail inside the firewall. And the reason it will work with any email system is that email is a federated service. Here is a thing called a message, formatted according to request for consensus 2021, and here is the material which says where it should go to get it there. It would be better for you if you had a mail server of your own and that everything weren't going to Gmail. The centralization of that service isn't helping you. It's allowing one part of the machine, which is deeply infected by the parasite with the mind of God, to read all the world's email, pretty much. That's not a good thing. But once the mail is itself secret, although anonymity is no longer present, and somebody is keeping track of all the email you send and receive, they're not keeping track of what was in it, at least not the stuff you considered to be private and important. If you complete exercise one, you will probably have completed the process of integrating GPG into your mail tool. Because one way or another, your mail tool will have now become GPG competent. And it will be pretty much easy to say with a click or fill a form or something that you would rather use encrypted mail. You might also have decided you'd like to have a mailbox at Proton Mail, which uses GPG automatically for you, creates keys and sends things, in which case your mail can be doubly secure because in addition to the Proton Mail GPG built into the transport, you're also using it between yourself and Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. So no matter what happens, you'll be better off. In no situation will you be worse off, except that you will have signaled to some listeners that you're a person keeping secrets, which under certain circumstances might be dangerous. Now we are back to exercise number two. We are trying to achieve anonymity, or as close as we can, given the technology that underlies the net. And we're trying to do that in such a way that a computer near your eyeball and eardrum could actually be functioning to remove identity from the substance of your communications. For this purpose, we are using the Amnesiac Incognito system. And the goal is to show you how you can use ordinary commodity laptop computers and so on in order to bring them up as systems that will communicate with good anonymity or as close to good anonymity as is possible over the net, and which will disappear entirely, leaving no trace behind on the physical computer where they were used. That's the requirement for working anonymity in the system. Now, we began talking about the King of the Undead, now dead, and his insatiable thirst for human livers because we were talking about the fact that much of the hardware you use now rejects the very attempt to run such an operating system on it. And so those of you who are using recent Macs with M1 and M2 silicon, what has happened is that the manufacturer of the computer has gone so deep into manufacturing the chips to its own design that our free software no longer runs there. You cannot use Tails. And so you say to me, how shall I complete this assignment? And I say, drop around my office and borrow a tiny old Chromebook garbage computer, or find one in a trash skip or under a bed, and learn, in other words, how to use all the other non-prestige, non-jewelry hardware around you to produce that working ability to relate to the net in an anonymous way, which your expensive, vastly over-expensive, over-controlling computer from those good, honest people at Apple who care so much about your privacy will not be able to destroy. Once you have a working tail system, you have an endpoint which is capable of using browsers in an anonymous fashion, and also, therefore, some other things like IM tools and mail tools and other forms of communication. You also have the capacity to use what is called onion sharing. That is to say, you can, in effect, put up a web server inside this world that can only be found by people who know how to look for it and who will preserve your anonymity because they won't be able to find where you are. If you look at the website of a modern newspaper like The Guardian and it says, we have a way that you can share documents anonymously with us so that we won't know who you are, but you can leak material to us which we as a newspaper would want to be able to publish. If you want, in other words, to be able to have WikiLeaks in a box for yourself, Tails is how you would do that. Anything you wanted to publish to the world securely in a way that couldn't be traced back to you, you would need no more than to boot that Tails disk that you made, put the file on that machine, start onion share, and send somebody the obscure-looking URL in the dark web, which would allow them to get that information anonymously from you. If you have an anonymous endpoint, then you can send them an anonymous email that says, over here are the things I wish you to have that I would be killed for giving to you, but you can get them safely from me. And once you have picked them up, they will cease to exist in the net altogether, and I can turn that laptop off, and we have done everything we need to know. And you have now, Mr. Guardian, Mr. New York Times, Mr. Washington Post, you have now the information that I wanted to give you, but I have given it to you safely. So a tail system will, even just in the first moments that you have succeeded in bringing it up on your own computer or some borrowed or stolen computer, the minute you have done that, you have become capable of disassociating identity from content in ways that would allow you to exercise what in the 20th century were regarded as straightforward freedoms. Questions? Yeah. Do you mean the time spent between the web server and you before you see the page, the time that Google calls latency? Yes, because running all these packets around through all these little tricks means that some milliseconds will have been wasted. But milliseconds, okay? It's not going to change whether you can get the work done today or whether you have to wait an hour after you click start. But yes, latency will occur because we're deliberately running packets around in the network in a way that tries to make them hard to follow. And in doing that, we have created inefficiencies. There are other kinds of inefficiencies that also will be introduced. If you are running a browser which removes ads, it will take a little time to remove the ads. But that won't matter because showing you the ads takes way more time than just receiving them. And so your ad blocker is not actually spending your time. It is reducing the amount of stuff you see, namely by the ads. If it is taking trackers out of what is going on between you and the web server, then it may sometimes be that the web server won't work because it wanted a tracker and you didn't give it one. If your browser is using NoScript, which is an attempt to prevent you from running all that evil JavaScript out there in the world that runs inside your browser that you have no idea what it is doing, then sometimes your websites won't work. I bought an airplane ticket earlier this week, and I paid for it with an American Express card. And because NoScript is constantly engaged in my browsers and I am running as little JavaScript from the outside world as possible, it took me a few extra minutes to complete the task of buying the airplane ticket. Because first the airline's website wanted me to run some JavaScript from some third party I wasn't running, and then mysteriously buying the ticket didn't work, and then American Express wanted me to relate to it in a different way than the ways I usually relate to American Express, because American Express and the airlines now have some new special high security system, and I wasn't running that JavaScript either. And so even after I finished telling the airline what ticket I want to buy and it says, okay, hold for American Express, that didn't work either. But I knew that what I had to do was allow them to run all this weird-ass third-party JavaScript just this once. And so I say to NoScript, hey, you know what? For the next 10 minutes, don't worry about it, okay? 10 minutes from now, go back to not allowing any of this stuff to work. But right now, let it work for me so I can finish buying this goddamn airplane ticket, okay? So there's an example of how it took longer, was less convenient, right? And there will be moments like that of all kinds, because it's very convenient to allow the parasite with the mind of God inside your mind. It's very convenient. So there will be a little reduction in convenience. You should expect that. We can make the sending and receiving of encrypted email basically frictionless for you, because your mail tools will simply know to do the right thing, though you will have to enter the passphrase on your secret key, because we're not going to remember that for you. That would be dangerous. That tail system will inevitably mean that the things you are doing are a little bit more cumbersome. But because we have changed the operating system in your computer, we have made them less cumbersome and more comprehensive, so that you're unlikely to foul up in a way which compromises you in fundamental terms and could get you killed. Other questions? Yeah.
Is doing this illegal anywhere?
It's relatively easy to violate the national security laws of the People's Republic of China. It is possible, because France is a very strange Stalinist country, to be engaged in illegally encrypting in France. Entirely likely that Tsar Vladimir can figure out a way to hurt you for doing this, but he can figure out a way to hurt you for not doing this pretty much in the same way. Anywhere in the world where holding up a blank sheet of paper in public can be regarded as criminal activity, there's probably a way that some prosecutor could get on your case about this too. We don't eliminate tyranny, but we don't comply with it very well. Is that an answer to your question or not?
Is the U.S. one of those places?
No, the U.S. is not one of those places. For using a tail system, as I've told you, analysts at NSA will say that you're an extremist, but they cannot prosecute you for it. And we can distribute all of this code in the United States without violating law either, because that's part of the work we did in the period before you came to law school. But effective tyranny would want to stop you from having secrets, and it would want to stop you from being anonymous. And as we have learned in the course of the course I did teach, which wasn't the course I should have taught, there's many ways of doing that. Which is why in the end, if we want to maintain freedom, somebody's going to have to take some chances somewhere. Good news is it doesn't have to be you, at least not this way. More about this? Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
So even if it's not legal for say, is there a chance that we might get put on a watch list of sorts?
Is there a chance that you might get put on a watch list? Well, you an American citizen carrying an American passport? No, I knew you weren't, but I mean, in a rhetorical sense, the empire regards you as open to pillage at any time, right? Section 702 and all of that, right? You're not an American, therefore we don't have to respect the rules as regards you. Can we put everybody in the United States who is not an American on a watch list? If Donald Trump is elected president in November, somebody will seriously try. Because the effort to ferret out all the people who are not legal people will be put on electronic steroids. I have tried to call your attention to the consequences of the use of such tools by the Israeli Defense Forces now in Gaza, in order to call attention to the fact that things which are presently being used to kill people, which is a pretty big use, will soon be used to do things that are much less damaging than killing people, but also very tyrannical. If I want to know where every illegal immigrant in the United States sleeps, Facebook and the other organs of the parasite with the mind of God could help me do that. Similarly, everybody trying to conceal where he sleeps can probably be identified by similar processes. Not all of us have tenure. The good news is even as a non-U.S. citizen, you will have a law license, I believe, and will be a member of a bar in the United States. And that will oddly trigger some restrictions on what people can do to you, because our federal government has rules made by the district, by the Department of Justice, about what can be done to interfere with lawyers. So even without the passport, the law license will contain certain, what shall we call them, repulsive powers. But pretty much you're an open book to them because you're not us. And us is still different from everybody else around here for the reasons we have talked about to some extent. Last week, when we met most recently, the university management had not yet used paramilitary police force against law students acting as lawyers. So we didn't get a chance to talk last week about that because even I would not have gone out on a limb to suggest that they would be such idiots as to arrest law students doing lawyering. I really thought that that would not occur. It did occur. But as you're probably aware, as of this morning, via triumphalist email from deans taking credit and what have you, what was done last Thursday night to arrest lawyers using paramilitary riot police by Tuesday had come apart, and Alvin Bragg's office had declined to prosecute the law students acting as legal observers arrested last Thursday night. Maybe you didn't get the same bragging email from Jillian Lester that I got this morning explaining how University General Counsel had courageously worked their asses off to make this happen, and also Professor Harcourt. The real meaning of that, you understand, is that by Friday morning, university lawyers had realized that using paramilitary police force against law students acting as lawyers was going to cause really a big bunch of trouble. And no doubt they began to try and cover the university's ass about that, and Bernard, which is the important part, actual lawyers doing actual work for actual people in trouble. And by Tuesday, the prosecutors have decided that they don't want to do that, and that means that those arrests will be expunged, and suddenly people's personal record, permanent records, will not be. And so the kind of fear you're expressing, that I will become a target and there will be, that went away. And so again, I want to point out to you how very important it is to be a lawyer and to have lawyers and to be aware of what it is that you got by going to law school and taking the bar exam and paying the money and all of that. The license is really good for you. I understand, of course, that everybody's level of fear is high. And it should be high, because I've been worried about this since I was 14 years old, and I wasn't wrong. But with a little bit of technical help and a law license and a little bit of courage, you can live a decent human life in the 21st century in many societies. Do not try this in Egypt. Other questions? All right, so then we are trying at a particulate level to interfere with particular processes. The goal is, by restoring some secrecy and restoring some anonymity to protect autonomy, by restoring the ability to make decisions which are neither interfered with by compromises of your secrecy, nor compromises that depend upon leveraging your identity against you. That's still only a very tiny set of pieces. That's because out here, you are still receiving a bunch of services. And those services are being provided to you in a form infected by parasitism. So if you go to edit a document together, or if you go to have a conversation with a small group of people, or if you go to share a file by dropping something off that somebody else is going to pick up, or if you send an email, you're sending those things or receiving those things or having those services afforded you in a parasitic fashion, where your behavior is being taken in return for the giving of these rather trivial services that you need, and without which it is your assumption that you cannot live. The problem in these cases, of course, is that you have an endpoint over here, and somebody else with whom you think of yourself as having an actual relationship has an endpoint over here. And the two of you are trustworthy with respect to one another, or at least you're human beings in relation to one another, which is something like that. The problem is that there is, in the middle, something else. And if that middle is not trustworthy, then the whole thing falls apart. In computer security, this is known as an entire class of insecure activity. MITM, it stands for man in the middle. Attacks against the integrity or secrecy of computer systems because there is a man in the middle, and the man in the middle is the source of the betrayal. The way your services are organized, the way you get the various things you get only because of a man in the middle, and the man in the middle isn't you, and therefore you are subject to the possibility of failure. Ideally, therefore, in addition to having a way of protecting data from listening and having a way to secure our endpoint, we would do something about all these persons in the middle. We would change the way we think about services in such a fashion as to reduce the vulnerabilities that come from the man in the middle. Here is where, once again, our understanding of how software works and how the network is put together will hurt us, because we don't understand the details very well. Because these things that provide us with these services are thought of as black boxes by us. All we know is that very wonderful, convenient services come out of them. And we did click yes on some terms of service agreement or other once upon a time back in the Stone Age when we were in a hurry. But the question, how could we manage the services in such a way that we aren't constantly man-in-the-middling ourselves, would require us, again, to use the software we possess, the stuff that makes services for us in freedom, and use them in such a way as to replace the things in the middle by things that we can trust. You think that would be hard because you think the economics of providing those services is very expensive. You think that to run Gmail and Dropbox and Zoom, it must be very complicated and sophisticated and very hard to do, and you need a lot of money and you need big computers and therefore you need capitalism, and it comes to seem, as so many other things have come to seem that we've been talking about this afternoon, like too much to handle. This is why, in the winter of 2009-10, as that all began to happen in a serious way, I went to NYU to give a talk on a Friday night, the burden of which was to say, Mark Zuckerberg has done more harm to the human race than anybody else his age, which was definitely true in 2009, but most of the human race didn't know it yet. And to propose that what we ought to do is to do something about all of this all at once. Which I call Freedom Box. We need to have a server of our own. We need to be able to do all of these things for ourselves and for the people around us. We need to be able to do that in such a way that we can all stand up everything we need, so that if we have only electricity and a network connection, not only can we provide those services to ourselves and to the people around us, but we can make it possible for everybody to do that. In order to do that, we would need cheap hardware that is not made like the King of the Undead, Now Dead's hardware to get in our way. We would need free software, that is software everybody can have, everybody can fix, everybody can improve, everybody can share, that would do all these things. And we need to have some physical place to connect that computer of ours to the net. A fulcrum, if you like, for a lever that can move the world. The purpose of the project Freedom Box was to say, let's get all that software together and make it really easy to use on the cheapest machinery around. Because although you are accustomed to thinking that it takes a lot of capital to be Google, and to provide you with Gmail and Google Voice and whatever the hell else it is that you're using, the truth of the matter is that for each individual human being, the total amount of resources necessary to do that work is tiny. It feels like it must be very big and expensive because centralizing it for a billion people turns out to be big and expensive. But that doesn't mean that for each and every person in the thing there's any very great cost or difficulty. Instead, really, actually, all the computing that you need to do all those things for yourself and everybody around you will fit in the palm of your hand. It will require less electrical energy than a 40-watt light bulb. It will basically operate forever on the basis of software that will automatically maintain itself. If anything goes wrong with it, you can throw it in the wastebasket and start again. This particular object cost $79, but in the end, if we wanted to make them in quantity sufficient for human beings to use in bulk, they would not have to cost more than $25. And even then, we could cheat a little bit. All the storage you need to do all the things that would ordinarily be part of your life as a human being is already in this box. But if you wanted to run a law practice on it forever and accumulate an entire lifetime of everything, you might want to have one detachable little hard drive attached to this thing by a cable. That hard drive would be fully encrypted at rest. So if at any time ever somebody actually wanted physically to take it from you, you could pull that cable out and tell them good luck. It'll take you 1,000 years to get the contents of that hard drive decrypted, which if they haven't stolen your keys is true. So we could do all of that. A mail server? That's trivial. There's never been a day in my grown-up life when I wasn't running a mail server of my own. Lots of people think it must be very difficult, but it's actually trivially easy. This Dropbox, yeah, I mean, there's absolutely no reason why if you want to synchronize a file from two devices of your own, or you want to leave a file for somebody else to pick up, or you want to leave somebody else the opportunity to drop you a file, that you would need anything except some third box in between your two endpoints. And it could just as well be this as anybody else's. In fact, one of the reasons that somebody might have a box like that is just to run sync thing and just to keep their things synced without sharing any of that data with third people. Zoom? Oh, yeah. I mean, why anybody uses Zoom is beyond my understanding. We have an endpoint which is known to be manned and demiddled by both Chinese and American secret services. Yeah, if you're having a Zoom conversation, they say, well, it's very secure because it's encrypted from here to here, but not in the middle. Zoom, of course, has the unencrypted version of all the conversations going on. Why should it? Free software for that same purpose, known as JitsiMe, which behaves very nicely in your browser and doesn't require you to download any apps or run any mysterious third-party code in order to have a video conference. JitsiMe runs very nicely in things like this. If you really wanted to have conferences constantly for less than 12 or 15 people, a little box like that would make that possible for you without any trouble. My JitsiMe server is a little virtual machine sitting on a box in my office which has no more memory or computing power allocated to it than a box like that. That's specifically why I run it the way I do, in order to starve it of resources. That video conference box of mine, that virtual machine, meet.moglen.us, doesn't have any writable storage. It couldn't keep a copy of any conversation going on over it, even if it wanted to, because it has no memory allocated for the purpose. It forgets everything the minute it's happened, the second it's happened, the millisecond that it's happened. Which is why, from my point of view, having office hours over a device like that is acceptable, and it wouldn't be under any other circumstance. You don't need to. Google Docs. Oh, my heavens. I mean, the dependence that we have on being able collaboratively to edit documents together, it's a wonderful thing. But the truth of the matter is that there's no software there at all. Google Docs is a degenerate version of a piece of free software called Etherpad. A less powerful version of Etherpad. Because when you make a Google Doc with people, if you want to take a portable copy out of Google Docs, as you are all aware because you've done it, you can have a version of the last version of that document, PDF or some other form of word processor input, but you can't have the whole history of the whole document, and you can't take it somewhere else and say, I'm not using Google Docs with it anymore, but I have a server and I'll run the thing and finish editing it among ourselves without a man in the middle. But that's only because those features have been removed from Etherpad in order to make Google Docs. It's just our free software disimproved to provide more corporate control. Running an Etherpad server of your own is easy. Pad.moglen.us, the one that I used for teaching classes all through the epidemic, ordinarily runs on a box like this. In other words, a Google Docs for everything I need, running on a thing that fits in the palm of my hand, that uses less power than a 40-watt bulb, and that nobody is inside, and there can't be man in the middle attack because I'm the man in the middle. Once again, easy enough for you. If I really were going to run a law practice anywhere on earth starting from zero, as you are, I would run it on a platform like that for sure. Because all those services that threaten the integrity of my work and that of my clients will cease to be a threat altogether. It'll be sitting inside some box locked in a lawyer's office, where if they really want to deal with it, they're going to have to get a warrant because breaking in on the other side is not allowed. Oh, to be sure, there are people who don't care whether it's allowed or not. Egyptian secret services operating in the United States, Narendra Modi secret services operating in Canada. We can all think of reasons why that security isn't necessarily good against state-level interference. If your threat model is active listening by national means of intelligence, that is, states breaking in on you, then you still have to be better than good. But if your threat model is anything less than the governments of the world trying to gang up on you, criminals, 12-year-olds, jealous husbands, bad people, you can deal with all of that immediately. That freedom box should also be sitting somewhere in your house or some other physical location that you trust, and you should be browsing through it. Now the location from which you are browsing, even if you're not using Tails, will disappear. The ads will disappear because the box will subtract them on the way in. The trackers will disappear because the box will move them on the way out. You will have an actual VPN, not a service which could be betraying you, but an actual virtual private network running from your smart-ass phone in whatever Starbucks you happen to be sitting in, back to your home or office where the Freedom Box is in an encrypted channel that will not give anything away. And suddenly, even though you're using a relatively insecure device on an absolutely insecure network, you have pretty secure communications. If you were a lawyer on the go who wanted to be able to do that from jails and courthouses using arbitrary government networks which are known not to be too good, you might put the Freedom Box software on a Raspberry Pi, a little thing that would fit in your handbag. And wherever you are, you connect it to untrustworthy wireless and you tunnel back to your office in an encrypted way and you use both docs and video conferencing and other services to support your practice. And even though you're sitting in a prison or a courthouse where you can be absolutely sure that the network isn't operating in your interest, you're safe and dry. And that was true because you had another little object in your bag that went along with that laptop or that smart-ass phone that you usually use. That horrible tablet. So by putting the pieces together at the end points and in the middle, by using very cheap hardware and software everybody's allowed to share, the result is that we can change how services are provided to ourselves, how we actually get from the nervous system we have wrapped around humanity the things that we think we need. When we have done that, we have cut ourselves a little bit loose. Now we begin a little bit more sophisticated stuff. And as I say, I wish I had taught this course correctly because we could be talking about that too now. We build a few things out of stealth material. Your shadow begins to disappear. The way you browse and the services you use in the net, even if you haven't been able to replace those services for yourself, you are still using them in fashions which leave much less behind for the parasite to gather in. You look sort of like a human being and sort of like a ghost. You are sort of trackable and sort of not. Some pieces of the parasite have kind of seen you out of the corner of their eye as they were going by, And some of them never focus on you at all because you're just not there, which is fine because there's billions of other people to scrape. And so the parasite goes on scraping the ones that are scrapable and it loses track of you because you're just not there. And of course, every time you come to a border and everybody starts asking about your social media accounts and so on, there is none. When I cross a border, the computer with which I am crossing that border is not openable by anybody on earth, including me. On the airplane, I have basically done the task before I landed of locking up the hard drive and throwing the key inside the hard drive I have just locked up. If I come to the border and the border wishes to tell me to open the hard drive, I literally can't. If they want to keep it, they can keep it, but they'll never be able to open it either. The key I need to open the thing I just locked and threw the key inside is sitting physically in my apartment. If I get home, I can open it up just as easily as if I open the lid. If I don't get home, good luck to anybody who still has it. You can do that. I don't know what will happen if you come to a border and they tell you to open it and you tell them that you can't. Maybe they'll kill you. But probably they won't. And the fact that you are known to be doing it, if you are a person known to the operator, if the border is known already, why bother seizing your stuff? It won't work. I mean, they can annoy you, but that's all. Can't actually harm your client. Because there's no way on earth they're ever going to get that data back. And that was at a border where your strength was at its minimum and their strength was at its maximum. You see, once you begin, you can follow on. Once you have started to get out, there's more out that you can get. It's still true that once you fell in, it was harder to get out than it was never to have started. You're still way worse off than I was because all these things have happened to you. I tried to prevent them at source because I knew they were coming and I didn't want them. But that doesn't mean we can't achieve a result which is every bit as good for you as it would be for you if you had never gotten in. Some of your habits will have changed, but the parasite has changed your habits already in bad ways and we would only be changing them back. Of course, it's true that if you bought really expensive Apple hardware, it might not work. But that's okay. Your next computer will be just as good and way cheaper. Questions? Okay, well, that was the course I should have taught. So we could consider that the advertisement for the course that I didn't teach. But it doesn't mean you can't still learn, you know. I mean, even if you graduate. And it certainly doesn't mean that we can't do together what we set out to do together, which is to save human freedom. It's possible. It might not work. But if it's going to be saved, then you're the people who are going to have saved it because you are the last generation in which the human race gets a choice. And now you know a little bit about what that choice is and some knowledge about how to exercise that choice, which means that you know how to know more if knowing more is what you want to do. Freedom depends now, as many of you have written, upon the elimination of ignorance about freedom. You keep writing essays about education will do this job, and I therefore find myself feeling even more inadequate because the education wasn't good enough. And in that sense, you're right, education can solve the problem, but not really. In order to solve the problem, there has to be free software, and there has to be free hardware, and there has to be bandwidth we can trust. And I said all that standing in the former Hall of the People's Deputies on the east side of Berlin in 2003. At a moment when East Berlin felt to me like it might be just the freest place in the world, which was not the East Berlin I had been in when I was younger. That was funny. At the beginning of the 21st century, there seemed to be a lot of ways in which freedom was suddenly increasing. And even in places in which I knew from my own experience that tyranny was present, it no longer was. But how things looked in 2003 and how they looked in 2023 are very different. We haven't gotten better freedom. You didn't get better education, at least not from me. It isn't that times have grown less dark. They are very dark indeed. But all light is not out yet. So, it was nice to spend some time with you. Thank you very much. See you around.